Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, welcome to Hollywood Crime Scene Presents Mysteries and the Macabre.
Ooh, Rachel.
I'm perfecting my intro for this.
Yes, we're going to get more professional here.
Yes.
By damn it.
Yes. God, oh, I just told us to speak up louder.
Oh, okay. I have to start being so sultry.
Yeah.
You have
to be more
mad.
Like me, very grating on the
okay,
ears.
Okay, I will.
Okay.
So today I'm very excited about this episode because it's very creepy and it's hitting, once again, the theme we're trying to hit this month is kind of creepy, ghosty, haunting, scary movie kind of stuff. So today I'm going to discuss the Doris Bithers case, aka the Entity Haunting. And you might know this story because it was the basis of a 1982 movie called The Entity that starred Barbara Hershey. Did you see this movie, Rachel?
I never did, but I know the movie.
Okay. I saw it a very long time ago, and I actually started watching it last night just because I was like, oh, I should just sort of refresh it. So it was like, it wasn't online streaming, but I found like a, I guess an illegal download, but it was dubbed in Japanese.
Awesome.
So I didn't watch too much of it, but I did watch a bit of the opening sequences
because
it gets heavy pretty quickly. So I think it is kind of a good movie that you should maybe watch this month in your 31 days of Halloween. Doris Bithers was born Doris McGowan. Her age is sort of something she never really reveals, so we don't know quite when she was revealed, but it would be sometime in the 50s.
Okay.
She came from a upper middle class family, but her family was very dysfunctional.
Yeah.
Like, she lived in a turbulent household, so it was not a calm upbringing despite the sort of wealth. Both of her parents were alcoholics and probably people who should just not have had children, which I think a lot of parents back then, it was like, you just had kids. It doesn't matter if you're
everyone did it.
Literally an explosive alcoholic. So at the age of 10, Doris and her family moved from the Midwest to California. There's not much about her early years, so this is sort of all I found. In her teenage years, she had a major altercation with her family, and there's no record of what that was, but it was so bad that her parents and her aunt and uncle disowned her, like, as
Whoa.
A teen. So she was completely cut off from them and didn't have any contact with her family anymore at that point. Eventually, they all died, I guess, shortly after.
Like, at the same time?
Yes. But, I mean, like I said, I have minimum information here.
That's very suspicious.
They all died very shortly after. Right. Doris is like the little girl standing in front of the burning house, that meme, smiling creepily. And she was left nothing in the will. The inheritance all went to her brother, which literally sucks because, like, one of my dreams is to get an inheritance from people I hate.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
So it's like I'm not sad they're dead, and then I get some money for all the suffering they put in my life. So,
it's very flowers in the attic.
I keep thinking, like, one day I'm going to get, like, a check in the mail because my dad died, who I haven't seen since I was, like, 13, and I'm going to get, like, all this money, and be like, fuck you, bitch. Like, we all have our dreams.
You know what? I'm going to pray. I'm going to put that out in the
Please
universe
Please send your love
you.
And light for me.
I will.
Your prayers.
I will.
So Doris continued her life of turbulence, you know, into her adulthood. She had numerous failed relationships, all of which included physical abuse. And she ended up having, like, in her 20s, she had 4 kids from 4 different men, which is like a telltale sign of someone who's not really great at relationships.
I would say so.
I mean, even my mom just had kids by 2 different men. Which is definitely more normal, probably. You know, she probably had a few abortions, though, so it could have been worse.
Well, my dad's had a lot of different kids throughout.
That's right. You have a similar.
But it's been throughout the span of, like, 30 years.
Right, not, like, 3 years.
Right.
Needless to say, being a single mom with 4 young kids, struggling financially, is a very stressful situation for anybody. And then she has that emotional, you know, from her background.
Right.
It's not like she's dealing with a great starting point to begin with.
She doesn't have a good
foundation.
She's troubled.
She also continues this cycle of abuse with her children. She doesn't have the greatest relationship with any of them. And they pretty much live in squalor their whole childhoods, the kids. They end up eventually moving to this home where the incidents will take place in Culver City, actually. And that home that they moved into had actually been condemned twice before they lived there. So I guess the landlord was just like doing these little shoddy repairs to make it pass inspection.
Wow, so sounds like my place.
Right. They're in like a pretty bad situation, I would say. But she's doing the best she can. Eventually, this guy's going to come in, but I'm going to tell you a quote now. His name is Dr. Barry Taff. He's a paranormal investigator, and he's pretty well-known now. But this would be one of his first big cases. He says the reason we don't have a lot of information about her early childhood is that she's really evasive and cryptic about her background, even when they were interviewing her. As I said before, she refused to even tell them her age, but his speculation was that they were a few years younger than her. So they're like in their early 20s, just starting off in their paranormal field. So she's definitely, you know, when this is happening, mid to late 20s probably. He said that nowadays, like, it's so different. They would have had to secure so much background information before they even took on her case. Like, currently, like, to go in as a ghost hunter or whatever, an investigator, they need your, like, medical records, your psychological records.
Really?
Family psychodynamics, medications that you might be on, your drug and alcohol use. Like, they really investigate these people before they take on the cases. And he speculates that if they had asked for that, she would have immediately been like, well, fuck you. No. Like, he also said that in addition to all of her, the psychodynamics of her family life, from a young age, she got mixed up in seances and Ouija boards.
Oh.
So she already had like a little bit of a spiritual obsession or interest going on. Her kids even said that she kind of had psychokinetic events or claimed to have psycho, like a Carrie type situation.
Right. Like telekinesis?
Yeah. And like other kind of, just like when she was in a room, like things would happen or weird. So she had some, according to them, she had some kind of like psychic, whatever, mojo.
Metaphysical.
Yeah. Like just like weird tricks, and like she could do impressive things. Like, and she was into this spiritual stuff to like, as like party tricks and bar tricks and like whatever, like look what I can do. Or have you seen this Ouija board? Let's have a seance. Like that kind of person. I love too, like in the interview, the kids are saying like how she had these psychokinetic events and would see occasional apparitions, and they described it as like more subtle things, paranormal stuff. And paranormal investigator was like, I would never refer to those things as subtle. I was like, okay. I mean, they do seem pretty intense. Like if I saw a ghost, I wouldn't be like, well, I just had a subtle experience. So another strange thing that happened is when she moved into this home on Braddock Drive in Culver City, she got a knock on the front door, and there was an old Mexican woman standing there who was in her 70s or 80s, and she delivered a message to her, and this is a quote, "You need to get out. I used to live in this old house back when it was just a farm and I was a little girl. There is something very evil. This place is haunted and you need to get out. Get out."
Yikes.
I like how it's always like, get out, like the ghosts are telling you, get out.
Right.
Anyways, that's like something that happened right when she moves into this house, and obviously is very unnerving for the whole family.
This is in the 70s?
Yes, this is 1974. Okay. So at some point, Doris goes to like a bookstore and overhears Dr. Barry Taff and a man named Carrie Gaynor, and they're at a bookstore kind of discussing paranormal occurrences and whatnot. So she's like, hey, like, things are happening. You like paranormal? You got to come over to my place. I got fucking paranormal. So she invites them to come over to her house. They come over on August 22nd, 1974, and they pretty much immediately begin their investigation into what's going on at Doris's house. According to Barry Taff, when they get into the home, like I mentioned before, it's in complete shambles. There are dirty dishes piled in the sink. I don't know. It just kind of reminds me of like some of my experiences growing up.
Really?
Just like having the house be disgusting because your mom works all the time and the kids are just, it's like cereal bowls piled up. Like things just aren't getting done because there's no one at home.
Right.
And the kids are making messes that aren't being cleaned up. Once they're at the house, she had basically kind of said, hey, there's some stuff going on, but she didn't really tell them the extent of it. And that's where she lays the fucking bomb on them of what's really happening. She claims that she has been multiple times sexually assaulted by a trio of violent ghosts.
Can I just say that when you said trio of violent ghosts, I immediately pictured the ghost from the Haunted Mansion. Like, you know,
like you're in the car and right. you're looking at them in the reflection and they're like groping you.
Right.
You're yeah. like, wait a minute.
Get out of my car.
That would be insane. Yeah. So according to Doris, the two smaller ghosts would hold her down while the tallest one would rape her. The woman, Doris's oldest son said that once he tried to intervene while the ghosts were raping his mom, and he was thrown across the room into a wall and he broke his arm. Dr. Taff and Carrie Gaynor had never heard of spectral rape before, so this was like new to them. But they saw like she had bruises all on her inner thighs and all over her body, so it kind of made them believe her. They did talk to neighbors, like they didn't just believe Doris's story, and they also claimed that they saw apparitions and stuff like inside the house or spooky things going on. And the children also were witnesses to things. They told the investigator that they dubbed the rapist ghost, the tall one, Mr. Who's It. Sorry.
Wow.
Like, that's
it's like a wrinkle in time.
That's like an insanely charming name for a rapist.
That's what I'm saying. That's like a little too cutesy.
Yeah, Mr. Who's It. Mr. Who's It's putting his what's it in mom again. Sorry. Look, I only joke about spectral rape.
Right. That's appropriate.
So anyway, I just think that name is crazy. But I mean, kids. So obviously once they hear this story, they're like paranormal investigator eyes light up. They're like, whoa, we have to get in on
this
story.
We hit the jackpot.
Yeah, we hit the jackpot. So they call in the rest of their team and set up all of the ghost watching and recording equipment, which at this point in time is very like, you know,
rudimentary
stuff. They don't like the high quality stuff they have today.
Well, they don't have proton packs even.
No, they have nothing. They set up these detect sort of equipment to see what's going on.
I just imagine lots of beeps and stuff and yeah. like very 70s.
And they're like holding like those things that have the lightning go back and forth. Like they're like
totally.
Holding it up. They have the bulb
right.
for the camera.
Yeah.
Nothing's happening. So they get Doris to summon the beings. Doris starts swearing and yelling at the ghost to kind of appear, which I feel like is that maybe she's trying to anger them to come out instead
yeah,
of entice them.
Maybe.
Investigators reported that they felt a strange pressure in their ears while this was happening, like whatever, like this, like I guess you're in an airplane, like the pressure drops
yeah.
or something. And then the lights, of course, began blinking and shaking.
The lights always flicker.
She continues to hurl these like ghost slurs at them. Or whatever, like she's really going off on these ghosts.
Or was she like, come here, you translucent
yeah.
bitch.
Yeah. Fuck you, you motherfucker. You're literally a motherfucker. And then they say that a green mist comes out and starts swirling
Ooh.
In a corner.
Well, that's very Disney.
Exactly. This is very Haunted Mansion. And it starts growing into a form of a muscular torso of a man. I'm sorry.
Was she like, yay, I got a hot one.
Yeah, it's like a centaur. So despite all this amazing equipment that they had, they still only managed to capture one image. I'll post some of these pictures because there's an image of this.
Oh, good.
And it's like one of those images. Doris is like, I can't remember if she's in a bed. She's like kind of crouched. And there was like a orby arc of light like sort of above her. The other thing that the investigators found out that they thought may have a certain element of bringing this supernatural stuff in is that two of the sons were really into Black Sabbath. I'm sorry, this sounds so like Satanic Panic of the 80s. Like, they also speculate that because there was so much emotional duress in this home, that could have been why this sort of spiritual stuff was happening there. But the paranormal activities were the strongest when Doris was there. Like, apparently it would happen off and on when just the kids were home. But when Doris was there was when things would really like light up. So eventually they do leave the house, and Doris claims that the entities followed her wherever she moved. She also claims that she became pregnant by one of the spectral rapes.
Stop it.
Yes. And she did have an ectopic pregnancy, but, I mean, obviously no one did DNA testing. She kind of disappeared in the late 80s, and then I'm going to get into this interview with her son Brian in a little bit. We did find out that she died in this interview from 2009, and she had a pulmonary arrest. But it's like a real sketch, like what happened to her So it's just according to her son, like, hey, she died. I mean, I think she's dead. It's not like she's living in Albuquerque or something. So obviously there's a lot of controversy about this case. Most of it sort of is like, this woman had a history of addiction, abuse. She had difficult relations, and she probably had some sort of mental break or stress-induced, like, psychotic break or something. Kids go along with their parents.
Right. Like, they're susceptible to believe stuff.
Right. According to Dr. Taff, contrary to what many people believe, the case of Doris Bither was not, in my professional opinion, the result of spectral rape, a.k.a. spectrophilia. Like, that has a word, by the way.
Wow.
He does think it was a poltergeist outbreak. He just doesn't believe the rape aspect of it.
Well, typical.
Right, typical
man. A man doesn't believe in rape.
This was before Me Too. and obviously, like I said, there's not a lot of data on ghost sex before this case. Sorry. There's just too many humorous things here. And he was like, but like I said before, he was in his mid-20s then. So the idea of that was very exciting at the time. But now, like, whatever, many years later and after thousands more cases, he just doesn't believe that it's something that exists. I think they also just need more evidence nowadays, like they didn't need back then.
I like that he has some humility about this early ghost hunting of his, that he's, like, able to admit, like, yeah, a lot of this was probably bullshit, instead of just, like, putting his foot down and being like, no.
It's an evolving science. So in this article I read were some of these clips from Dr. Taff. In the comment section of that article, Doris's middle son, who is named Brian Harris, left a comment.
Oh, hell yeah. What did he say?
I'll read it to you. He said, my mother was not on drugs. She drank a lot of beer to calm her nerves and became dependent on beer. It went from a couple beers to a buzz to full stupid slurred drunk. This was always clean and neat. We were very poor, but my mother prided herself. This is like really broken English, but it's not written well, would never show that side of our lives. There was never, ever dirty dishes in the sink. I and my younger brother had to see to that. Please take a grain of salt of what you read. There are so many interpretations what really happened in the story that the real truth isn't even the only speculation is what you're mostly reading here on these blogs. You're hearing this from the sound of Doris. I have no idea. That's just what it says. He is like, okay, he's like the only one of her children that is simpatico with her still. Like,
really?
He is kind of like Bob Crane's son.
Oh,
do you know
yeah.
what I mean? Like, the defender. He's going to defend his mom. Like,
right.
There's always, like, the one kid, I think, who mm-hmm. becomes the caretaker.
Well, like Woody Allen. Well, doesn't he have, like, one son who's,
right.
Like, fuck
you. For some reason, when I heard it, I was like, well, I don't know if Sun Yi is his defender. His one child defended him and married him.
So he must be.
She counts.
Right. Would his own wife, daughter say anything bad about him? No.
So I'm going to just go over some of the more things that Brian says in this interview that came out in 2009. And it is with a man named Javier Ortega, who has a blog called Ghost Theory. I didn't explore that blog too much, but it definitely looks like one of the, what is the?
Geocities.
It's like that
they
level.
They all look like that.
Right. Yeah. The more we've done this show, the more I'm on these blogs. I'm like, how is this blog still operating?
Right.
Like, this technology. And sometimes you'll see, you're like, there hasn't been a post since 1999.
Well, that was like the Winchester Mystery Theory guy.
Oh, right. Yeah,
it was
yeah.
Who designed this and what year did they design this website?
Right. blog.blogspot.
It wasn't even, it looked like Angel Fire.
Yeah, it's worse. It's like something, it's so, yeah, it's insane. But anyways, there's some good information in here. So as I said before, he's definitely like the chip off the old block. He's his mama's, you know, little boy or whatever. He's still very defensive of his mother. He described the overall feelings of growing up in the house as that everyday life was just being isolated most of the time. They were in this small house and we felt physically separated, alone, and isolated from the rest of the world, which kind of like breaks my heart because I feel like that is very true. If you're in like a troubled household, you don't want anyone in your house.
Yeah.
Like, even if it's clean, it's kind of like, I don't need anyone seeing what's going on. You don't want your teachers to know. Like, so there is like an isolated feeling, I feel like, when you're in an abusive situation like that.
Right.
And whether or not the ghost stuff is true, she clearly was sort of not on her best mom level. Like,
right.
You know what I mean?
She had her own problems.
Right. He denies that the house was condemned. He said that that's all bullshit. The house was never condemned, and that it had a reputation for being haunted in the neighborhood long before, and that there were prowlers coming by and curious people, and that's maybe why people thought it was condemned, because it was sort of the haunted house of the neighborhood, and it probably was vandalized in between tenants because they just rented the house. They didn't own it. He, in the interview, the guy asked about the rape, obviously, to see if that was true. He asked the question, like, was your mom raped? Did it really happen? And in the interview, it says it was silent for 6 seconds or so. And after that, Brian sighed. I'm sorry. like come on, question. You know that this question is coming up. It's like the most interesting detail. What do you want to know? It was all true. Well, mostly true. Have you seen the movie? Yeah, the movie did add a lot of things. Barbara Hershey did a good job. It was exactly as I remember my mother going through it. The bruises on her legs and inner thighs, the attacks. Living in that home was hell. We all experienced some form of attack. There was pushing, biting, scratching being done to us, meaning the children as well. He claims there was 4 entities actually in the house, and they were always making themselves known at all times, which he considered something that took a lot of energy from people in the house. Like, yeah. The activeness of the ghost kind of sucked everyone else sort of dry of their energy. He also claims, like, the ghosts were like a fog in the silhouette of a human. So, I mean, a lot of this reminds me of kind of alien abduction, where people are sort of saying things that you've heard before, and it's sort of hard to say. It's like, well, are you just repeating things you know? He does describe the main ghost as having that chiseled body, but it wasn't like a full figure. It was just like
a torso
that was like cut. It was swole.
So it was a disembodied torso and dick?
I guess. He doesn't mention the dick. And then he does, I didn't see this, but I guess somebody claimed that the ghost were Asian. And one of the stories are important. He strongly denies this theory, this accusation, not accusation, that the ghosts were Asian. I don't know. I never saw that in any of my research, but there's like a whole section of here. He's like, they're not Asian. Dr. Taft tried to make it look like the spirits were Asian, but they were most definitely not. It seems like a weird point. It's like, well, whether they are or not seems very irrelevant.
It seems so irrelevant to the case.
But that was a big detail for him. So I wanted to pay him respect and tell you guys the ghosts were not Asian. He claims that his room was right next to his mother's room. So he would hear the rapes happening and he would hear things being thrown. He would hear her screaming. And then she would come out of the bedroom after the attack with bruises all over her. So he was just standing there, and he would see them beat. Like, he would see them beating her. Like, he could see her just standing there being beat, but there was nothing there.
Whoa.
Yeah. So that seems pretty creepy. Like, he could hear the slaps, he said. I mean, that's kind of a disturbing thing, because you wonder what was really happening in that moment.
Yeah.
Or also just the idea, like, it always triggers me when moms let their kids see certain things. Like, if I was having an attack like that, I would be like, kids, go in the other room.
Right.
Like, there's something about her that she wanted them in on it. I don't know. Like, it's all a bit messed up, I think. The whole investigation, by the way, only lasted about 2 to 3 months. And that's like another point of contention for Brian. Like, he feels like Barry Taft made his career on this and like knows all this stuff, but he was only there a few months, and Brian is really the expert on this case. So there's like a lot of possessiveness, I think, about what happened in this story. He also talked about the telekinetic, psychokinetic kind of stuff I talked. He says the home was unstable. We did fight a lot. My older brother was mean to us, so there was a lot of tension. My mother's boyfriend at the time left because he could not handle the poltergeist and the tension, which was a good thing. He was a bastard. I mean, I always appreciate people who have a petty aside during like a different conference. Right. By the way, this guy was a dick. You don't know who he is, but I'm just going to put that out there
in case
he's reading this. So he thinks like maybe the telekinesis stuff was possible, that she was actually doing it rather than a separate entity being in the house. He also claims that a lot of the negative energy in the house was caused by the ghost hunting team being there. There were 20 to 30 people in the room at a time, like in this small house with all of this equipment yelling at the ghost to come out. I mean, it sounds like a mess.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't sound very professional to me. Brian also takes credit as being the one who came up with the name Mr. Who's It, which I also love. Like, that's something.
That
he's like,
genius name was me, guys.
Hey, just so you know. And he said that he called the ghost Mr. Who's It because he believed it was his grandfather initially, and he thought it looked like his grandfather, but then when he realized it wasn't his grandfather, he came up with Mr. Who's It. Like, oh, I guess I was wrong. It's not my grandfather. It's Mr. Who's It. I have no idea.
I look, but Brian, I wouldn't brag about your
right.
name.
Just say you came up with it. Don't give us the stupid explanation. He also says about the Black Sabbath music. He says that music had no influence on the ghost coming. That's all bullshit. We never even listened to satanic music. Any kid that grew up in the 70s listened to rock, and that's what they listened to. It was the cool thing to do. Sorry, Brian, calm down. So he's like, we never played certain songs that would agitate the spirits. There is one song on the Uriah Heep album, Demons and Wizards, that talks about good versus evil. It's basically about the devil getting his ass kicked. Every time we would play that, the spirits would become agitated. I mean, this guy's played Dungeons and Dragons, right?
Oh, he had to have gotten into it later.
So as I said, they eventually moved to Carson. They left the house, and he does agree with his mom that the spiritual activity continued as they went to the house. He also rags that neighborhood, Carson, saying it was a bad neighborhood and a bad school system. Brian has some petty grievances.
Right.
He also, this interviewer asked Brian about the pregnancy, and he said, it's possible. I mean, my mom moved around a lot. She was so unstable, we would lose contact with her. She had a lot of boyfriends and husbands, so many that I lost count. So it's possible one of her boyfriends got her pregnant.
Wow.
So that's the end quote of that interview. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about the movie. The movie is, it's not like her name. It's, they changed the name to Carla Moran, but it's like so much of the same story. Like, she sees the psychiatrist at a bookstore, yeah, and has them come in. Like, the rape scene happens very early on in the movie. Like, it's in within the first 15 minutes, I think.
So is it just Barbara Hershey, like, bucking on the bed?
Basically.
Right.
Yeah, it's basically that. As I said, I didn't watch the whole movie last night. I just kind of poked around it a bit. But it does kind of follow Doris Bithers' story until the end. Like, there's an insane ending when the psychiatrist comes and, like, things just explode and they're, like, in this house that's a mock-up of her house to try to get the ghost to come there.
Oh, whoa.
And then there's just this whole, like, you can tell where they spent the budget, like, the special effects sequence.
The real house is still up today, isn't it?
I think so.
It still exists.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think anything has happened there ever. The best part of the movie, though, is after they, it's kind of like the end of Carrie. You know how Carrie has that button where you think it's the end of the movie and then,
yes,
it's like the button at the end, the sort of famous whatever.
It's a great scene.
It's a really great scene. This movie has a sort of similar thing where you think everything's solved and she goes back to the house the next day. And then the minute she walks in, a demonic voice says, "Welcome home, cunt." Sorry.
Oh, that is great.
And then she packs up and leave and it's sort of the button. I guess, is that a spoiler? Oh, who cares?
You know what? That is a spoiler, but that's too good not to share with me on
the
show.
I have to. Welcome home, cunt. Martin Scorsese actually considers this one of the scariest horror films,
really,
of all time. Uh-huh. And one other little interesting thing about the movie, I mentioned earlier that one of the son's arm was broken when he tried to save his mom from being raped,
right,
or stop the rape. And the kid who played the son in the movie actually broke his arm while filming.
Whoa.
So that's sort of like a creepy little thing. And they actually had to write the broken arm into the movie for the other scenes because it wasn't like in the script.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm a huge fan of Rocket Money. Not only did they help me find and cancel some of my unwanted subscriptions, in general, they've given me a great picture of my financial status and helped me save money. I've always struggled with finding time to manage my finances. At the end of a busy week, the last thing I want to do is spend time budgeting all of my expenses or tracking down customer service teams to cancel old subscriptions I no longer use. But now I use Rocket Money, and it does all that for me. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. With Rocket Money, I have full control over my subscriptions and a clear view of my expenses. I love the dashboard that shows me this month's spending compared to last month's, so I can clearly see my spending habits. Plus, they'll help me create a custom budget and keep my spending on track. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of 500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Hollywood Crime Scene. That's rocketmoney.com/Hollywood Crime Scene. rocketmoney.com/Hollywood Crime Scene. So that's the Doris Bither story.
Yeah.
And I actually have one more single mom ghost story to tell you. It's not as long, but it's sort of connected because Barry Taff also worked with this woman.
Okay.
When I was researching Doris, I was on a YouTube video, someone in the comments was like, oh, I thought this was going to be the Jackie Hernandez story. And I was like, oh, what's that? So I looked up her, and then there's a lot of stuff on her too, because this was also quite famous ghost case. So Jackie Hernandez, she had just recently left her husband. She's 23 years old at the time. So she moves from LA after the divorce, and she moves to San Pedro, California. I think that this is sometimes referred to as a San Pedro haunting.
We call it San Pedro, by the way.
Oh, Pedro?
I used to do a lot of drugs down there.
Okay. Look, I always defer to drug addicts.
I'm just saying, even though that's not the correct Spanish
pronunciation. There's a lot of that in California, where I always say things like, I used to say San Rafael, and everyone's right. Like, San Rafael, dumbass. And I was like, well, it doesn't sound right.
It's so stupid, because we should be pronouncing it the correct way.
Right. But then instead you're judging people who say it the correct way.
Yeah, because everyone I knew from San Pedro pronounced it Pedro, and I thought it was hilarious when I first heard it. But now when I hear people say San Pedro, I'm like, hold on, this isn't La Isla Bonita.
Right. San Pedro. People, yeah. Wait, that's probably how I learned how to say it.
Right.
Okay. Thank you, Rachel. Rachel always tells me why I do things. It's great. She always informs me. As with Doris, a young single mom,
yeah,
she's struggling. She is in a stressful new situation without a husband.
Look, the last thing you need is a fucking ghost talking.
Seriously, it's hard enough to raise kids. So she's working multiple jobs, and she's also, by the way, pregnant with her second child.
Wow.
So she leaves her husband pregnant with a 2-year-old. I mean, that's a mess. What a dick that guy must have been.
He must have been awful.
He must have been awful to leave under those circumstances, right? I mean, who knows? I'm not judging the poor guy, because he does come back in the picture. maybe she was the one. The spooky kind of stuff started happening right away, but it was very small at first. She would hear sounds like high-pitched screeching coming from inside the walls. Oh. Or she would hear things in the attic like shuffling and thumps and things. So it's kind of like things I'm sure you initially just brush off like, oh, it's windy today or whatever. So one night she has a friend over, and they're just cooking dinner, and they see several orbs of light float through the room. She tries to take a picture, and in the picture, she sees a face of a emaciated old man staring in the window.
So
it's sort of in the background. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing worse than an emaciated old man staring at you.
Dude,
that is a primal scary image, right?
Yeah.
So obviously she looks outside, and there's nothing there. So I don't know, maybe they were taking Polaroids. That would be very 70s.
I used to have a reoccurring nightmare, because I had crazy nightmares when I was a kid, probably because of just all the chaos in my life. Right. But I would have reoccurring nightmares about a haunted camera and a creepy old man. But I know that the creepy old man was from Poltergeist too.
That's classic.
But I also would have creepy dreams about taking pictures and seeing pictures of ghosts.
Right.
So that is one of my biggest nightmares.
Can I just say one of my early horror movie experiences that literally traumatized me for life. And I don't even know if this movie is good. It's called, what is it called? Wait Until the Dark, or Don't, I can't remember. It's something like don't turn the lights off. Don't turn the lights off. Okay. And there was a sequence in the movie that literally traumatized me as a child. Like, it's so scary to me. I don't even know if I could watch this movie again, because that's how, like, visceral it is for me. So it's basically this woman living in a scary house, and there's, like, kind of, like, troll-like creatures in the basement, and no one believes her, and they're afraid of the light. I think they actually remade this movie a few years ago. And there's a scene, the scary scene for me is, it's towards the end, and she... all the lights are out. They've turned all the lights off in the house, so she can't turn the lights on, and that's how she keeps them away. And they're dragging her into the basement, and all she has is a Polaroid camera. Oh my God. She keeps flashing the camera because that will get them away for a few seconds. But then eventually she obviously runs out. The flash burns out because it's like one of those cameras where the flash will burn out like a bulb.
Right.
And it's just like the most horrifying sequence because they're like grabbing her feet, and I have like a traumatic fear of people grabbing at my feet, like,
oh my God,
the getting out of bed thing, like,
right.
So just like that scene scared the fuck out of me as a kid.
I need to watch that.
You have to watch it. I'm just curious what that scene is like, because it was the scariest thing I ever saw with like fucking camera. I was like, oh my God, like, so I've had nightmares about that still. Anyway, people typically will try to blow these early experiences off as like, oh, it's just the wind or whatever. Obviously, this took it next level. Jackie wanted to do something. She talked to her ex-husband, whose name is Al, and he suggested they get a priest in to like do an exorcism type thing. So they do this before they do the paranormal investigators. At some point, one of her friends tells the landlord about what's going on too. So like people are starting to know what's happening here. They bring the priest in. Nothing basically happens. He declares that the house is not haunted, but that Jackie is possessed by the devil. I mean, obviously the priest is like, the priest is going to priest.
Right.
He's like, no, that's not what's happening. You're possessed by the devil.
Right.
Like, hello. Once the priest leaves, Child Protective Services was actually called at some point because people in the neighborhood are talking and stirring up shit and saying that she's basically a bad mom. So they called CPS because they thought maybe she was on drugs or something, but she's not. So she starts feeling really, at this point, scared and trapped because no one's believing her. She's still pregnant. And that was part of the thing too, like she's on drugs while she's pregnant kind of thing. Mm-hmm. She eventually gives birth to her daughter, Samantha, and the hauntings continue and they kind of ramp up. In fact, she claims that once she was bringing in groceries and that the magnetic refrigerator letters, you know, like the kids have, spelled get the hell out once again.
Wow.
The classic. I mean, that would be a great image in a movie, right?
Oh yeah.
Just like the alphabet, like the primary color magnets. Mm-hmm. And obviously there's no signs of break-in or anything. So she knows that the ghosts have like re-upped their terror. So that night when she goes to sleep after she's put her kids to bed, she claims that she hears raspy breathing in her ear while she's lying in bed. She feels like the breathing gets more and more distant, so she follows the sound to her son's bedroom. And when she looks inside, she sees the same emaciated old man sitting next to her son, staring down at him with burning red eyes. Obviously, that's very scary.
Yes.
So she like is terrified, and then she also claims that a blood-like substance begins oozing from the walls, like in his room. From that day forward, things just keep, you know, escalating. She continues seeing puddles of blood wherever she was. Like if she was in the kitchen and she goes back to the kitchen, there's a huge puddle of blood where she just was before that wasn't there. She also says that objects start flying around the room. And she even goes so far to admit that she does think she's losing her mind. Like she doesn't know what's happening. It's kind of like you start believing like, well, maybe I am crazy. Like what the fuck is going on? So it is at this point, her friend named Susan tells her about Barry Taff. So they bring Barry Taff in to do an investigation. And this is after Doris Bithers. I think this is in the 80s. I forgot to write the exact date down. So his team arrive and they don't have to have her scream at the ghost for them to come out. They're immediately like showing off.
Whoa.
There's a foul smell in the room where they're sitting and kind of taking their initial report or information, whatever.
Apparently ghosts smell.
Yeah. They start at that point in the attic. They start hearing banging sounds. According to Taff, we kept hearing what sounded like a 200-pound rat running around the attic. Jackie actually traces the source of the banging to a part in the ceiling above her kitchen, and she claims that this is where she has seen a ghostly image of a severed head before, like, and hearing muffled voices at the same time it appears. So Taft's cameraman goes into the attic to see what's happening and what the source of this banging is. That must be the scariest job, by the way. Could you even imagine?
I couldn't do this job.
So according to the cameraman, whose name is Jeff Wheatcraft, he goes up there, and when he's up there, immediately an unseen ghost or force throws the camera down that he's holding and starts choking the cameraman. The crew leave after this attack, and that guy actually never comes back, Jeff Wheatcraft. He's like, I'm done. The one night, like, this is according to Jackie's, like, her breaking point, which is, like, hard to believe because it's like, how is that other stuff not your breaking point? She says that a ghost begins to play with her son toys in her in the room to kind of get her attention, and he throws a beach ball at her, and then when she goes to get the beach ball, he attacks her. The ghost, like, physically attacks her for the first time. So I guess the idea of, like, them playing with your kids' toys, I can see how that would be really creepy, like, it's sort of like, hey, bitch, I'm playing with you. Your kids are
not
safe.
It's a warning.
Like, yeah, it's kind of a warning. So I can imagine that being very scary. She said that what felt like a hand, held her down until she couldn't breathe. When she finally got to her feet, she grabbed a baseball bat and inexplicably, in my opinion, ran to the attic. Sorry.
Well, you never run to the attic.
That's like, come
That's
on.
Classic.
How do you even run to the attic? It seems like a chore.
Well, you got to, like, get the latch thing right down. And
there she said that the creature, she called out to the creature. So she's doing, like, one of those, like, come on, with her baseball bat.
Right.
And he appears before her, but she doesn't do anything. She calls Barry and the crew at that point, which is probably a smart thing. She gets the kids and she leaves the house for the last time. But the crew was still there to investigate what had happened. So they're back there. They're up in the attic. I told you before, like, one of the members had already left. So the other people are kind of freaking out. There's a new photographer there and a new cameraman. They're back up in the attic. And then once they're up there, someone once again grabs the photographer by the neck with a clothesline and attempts to hang him. There's a picture of this that we could post. Because the other photographer snapped a photo of the guy hanging before he helped tie him down, which seems kind of rude.
Like, that
wait, hold
rude.
On 1 second. Oh,
yeah. Wait.
Let me get this picture.
Let me get the shot.
So there is a picture of that, the guy hang with like a thing around his neck, kind of in a hanging position. So as I said, she does leave San Pedro.
I don't care.
And she gets to another house, and much like Doris Bithers, the hauntings continue. Her ex-husband, they kind of get back together. I guess things are just bad. They need to be together, and he needs to help her with the kids and whatnot. They start having the ghost experiences, and then things kind of die down. But then at some point, they start up again. Like, just when she feels safe, they kind of go up. So I don't really know, like, what's going on with her. She says that she and neighbor are watching TV and they see the glowing face of a gaunt old man again, the same one from her San Pedro house, like in a storage shed in the backyard. And then that night after they see the face, she hears someone pounding on the inside of the same shed, like as if they want to get out.
Did she then go to the library with the microfiche and start looking to see who died?
She's like, I'm going to take care of this. Well, Rachel, you hit the nail on the head.
That's what I would do.
So the crew comes out to her new house, which I think is maybe in Inland Empire, but none of their electronic equipment will turn on when they're there. So it's like they're disabled completely. They take out a Ouija board and use that to try to communicate with the spirits rather than the official equipment.
They're like, we have to do this analog.
And this is where they kind of find out some history of the ghost.
Oh, hell yeah.
So she kind of wrote down all of the stuff that was happening during the Ouija board seance, and she has like a transcript of this. She claims that the ghost told her that they had been drowned in San Pedro Bay in 1930. His murderer lived in her old house in San Pedro. He also told her that there were more ghosts hanging around, and if that weren't enough, the ghost also said that it had tried to hang a member of Barry's crew because he looked like his murderer.
Whoa.
So that's like all the information they got from this seance.
Well, what was their excuse for attacking her?
I don't know. Just because she was in the house, I guess. I don't know. Maybe they were trying to get her attention. Like, isn't that common in ghosts where they're like, find our murderer, but they don't tell you right away? The hauntings actually do kind of die down. it's all, people speculate like the man finally got his chance to tell his story and yeah. that he kind of died down
well,
because of that.
Well, people just want to be heard.
You know what, Rachel? That is very true. She also says that one time she was visiting San Pedro and she saw the orb of light there leave her old house and it settled over a headstone that read John Damon. I mean, I don't know how she followed this orb of light, but I'm just going to believe Jackie. This ball of light went around and around the grave and then just disappeared. Barry Taff, he claims that he did some investigation and that the ghost in the attic was the spirit of a man named Herman Hendrickson, who was a 28-year-old man who drowned in San Pedro Bay in 1930. So he did find a person who matched up with what wow. they found in the seance.
So who was the old guy?
I don't know. I mean, they're not lining everything up. I mean, maybe this ghost aged.
That's interesting, because usually they don't age.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know a lot how ghosts work, or if they just present a certain way, like a more effective way.
Yeah.
I read a funny tweet, actually, a few days ago, where they're like, how come ghosts are always, like, from the 1800s, and it's not one who died in 2015, and they come in, and they're like, it's hey, bitch, it's Britney, or whatever.
right.
Like, it's never like someone from 2 years ago, like, hey, bitch.
Right. Totally.
They're always like you said, the Haunted Mansion style ghosts.
It's
like,
always Victorian.
Right. So it is kind of like, well, what are ghosts and how do they present to you? Do they present in a way that will make you affected?
Right.
Because I want the gay Britney ghost.
I want that ghost
too. That will make
too.
Me believe them. Now, much like Doris Bithers, a lot of people speculate that it was this emotional distress that yeah. either had her seeing these things or contributed to them happening. Like,
right.
because she was such a emotional mess, the ghosts were easily, like, drawn to her.
She was vulnerable.
She was vulnerable to that. But there has been nothing, according to Jackie, nothing has happened since those initial
in that house.
Things. And once they kind of figured out, well, she's not in the initial house or the second house either. She moved back to, I guess, L.A. proper.
Oh, so this woman hasn't had any
nothing.
Spirits
after
since.
They did the seance and okay. she saw the one orb when she went back to San Pedro, nothing else has happened.
And is she still adamant that this happened? Is she
yeah.
still like, yeah?
I mean, pretty much.
Right.
Yep. So those are my two single mom ghost stories.
I love those. Because I knew the entity one because I actually almost did it for a bonus episode once.
Oh, okay.
But I didn't. So it was really good to hear that story, but I had never heard of this story before.
I didn't either.
Either.
It was literally crazy. In a YouTube comment, and I just followed the trail, and
yeah.
then there was much more information.
Good sleuthing, Des. Yeah.
So YouTube comments aren't always useless.
Well, I'll tell you my theory about this kind of haunting. I mean, it's just one theory I have. Like, obviously, I believe in ghosts, but I do think that it's interesting, like, both of these women had traumatic lives. They both had a rough time. They had
They're
a rough go.
Stressful.
Right. And I think that I'm looking at it like, okay, if this was a horror movie, what would the allegory be if this was an actual horror movie? Well,
right.
all horror movies are political or have some commentary on social
yes.
issues.
Yeah.
All horror movies
right.
do. So if this was a horror movie, for me, it would be sort of, it reminds me of like, you know, a Hereditary type situation where it's like, the allegory of Hereditary had so much to do with generational trauma, generational mental illness. I do think that vulnerable people like are more susceptible to seeing ghosts, whether or not sometimes it's just mental illness or whether or not they're actually just more vulnerable to communicating
right.
with the spirit world, which
right.
is why children so often see ghosts,
yes.
which is why I think I had so many metaphysical experiences when I was a little kid, because I did have a really traumatic childhood in my early years, and I was just fucking stressed and suffering from whatever, untreated alcoholism
right.
when I was a kid.
Yeah.
So like, I think that can be a contributing factor. I don't know. I haven't like written a thesis or come up with a
no.
thesis on this. I'm just like spitballing here.
Well, and I don't know a lot about horror movies as much as you do anyway, but there is also something that I have seen a lot in horror movies, and it is the idea of this, like a female or a
yes.
mom in particular
yes.
not being believed.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like an experience of something horrible, which obviously we can relate to many experiences
yeah.
being a woman. And it is interesting how that always happens. So there
right.
is this idea, I think, especially probably in the 70s and
oh,
like
yeah.
longer ago, where you don't feel believed or respected.
Right.
And you're a mom and you're under a lot of pressure and stress, like working with kids and da-da-da-da. And it's just like, you want to be seen in a right. way. And well, it's like, I'm not believing them, but I can see how that manifests into something right. like this.
If it's whether or not the ghost story is true or not.
They're clearly going through something.
She's going through something right. and she needs it dealt with.
Right.
You know?
Oh, definitely.
And she
for
needs,
sure.
She needs help in some capacity. So that is very interesting. I will have to, I mean, my thoughts are not very organized right now
because
both of us are, it's like
barely
the morning.
Woke up.
Yeah. We're like hardly awake right now.
So be impressed.
But I think this was a really good episode.
Okay, good. Thank
I'm
you.
I'm excited about it. Okay.
Thanks. Bye.
Guys.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.